Hello everyone and welcome to the latest episode of the Squawker Talker podcast. After a weekend of saves, ratioed tweets and everything else in the footballing world, I'm joined today by Mohamed Butt, chief writer at Squawker, to talk about it all.
Hoping to get better ratios than Rio Ferdinand this weekend.
Exactly.
But that was
feeling good though.
Yeah. You've stepped on his preview of the...
No, I mentioned it just the then subject. Anyway. And Will, I hadn't even introduced you yet, well, and you've decided to perk
up. You've denied him his big reveal, basically, in the same way I've denied him his intro to me.
Exactly. So a deniers podcast starts. But how are you, Will? Anyway,
I'm good.
If people didn't know, you're on this podcast.
Hello, here I am.
So after that seamless... perfect introduction that Squawker Talker has become famous for.
Well, I think. Always say we're fluid, so I'm trying to sort of dismantle the conventions.
Well, I think we've become too fluid there. It's a free-for-all to start with. But what we will start with is the Man United-Spurs game, because I think the final game of the Premier League weekend, it was one of the best. It was intriguing. There was plenty to talk about. One person that became the talking point first was Paul Pogba with that delicious counter-attacking, sweeping pass to Rashford, who then scored. And that means that Pogba, since Ole Gunnar Solskjaer took charge, or Mourinho's been sacked, whichever sort of way you want to look at it, positive and negative there, no player's been directly involved in more goals in the Premier League. He has 4 goals. That was his 4th assist. So all of a sudden, are we now watching the best Premier League midfielder?
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. Talent-wise, it was always, no one ever denied that this is, oh, Pogba has the talent to be the best midfielder in the Premier League. But it was always just about, oh, he can't seem to put it together. Oh, he just can't seem to play a run of games and really show his ability. And it was the contention was, oh, is he actually not that? Like, does he not have the mentality to do that? Graeme Souness is still pushing that angle hard, you know, even after that performance. But, you know, what many people sort of correctly realised was, yeah, his manager is not the kind of manager, not the best kind of manager to get the most out of him. Didier Deschamps has shown, is a similar kind of reactive manager to Mourinho, but like he's Mourinho, like before, like he's Mourinho 10 years ago, before Mourinho lost whatever it was that he had that made him so good. Deschamps, and even Deschamps has shown in qualifying, it's not easy to get everything out of Pogba. In tournaments, he gets Pogba playing well because it's a short burst against, like, okay, Paul, just do this for me, whatever, whatever. But normally to get Pogba playing well, you have to be like Antonio Conte or Max Allegri and say, okay, you're the most advanced of our 4 midfielders. You go forward, you impact the game in the final third. You can play passes at the back if you want, but go forward. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer quite clearly has thought, okay, go forward. He's just given him license to run. So like you said, 4 goals, 4 assists. You know, he's created the most chances since Solskjaer took charge, 13 chances in open play. He's had the second most shots in 18 shots. Only Kane has more. He's created 3 big chances, which only Salah, Westwood, Iwobi and David Luiz have more.
You know, I wouldn't have used that stat to back him up.
No, I mean, that's not bad. Big chances.
That's more of like a pro-Westwood stat than
Well, I mean, yeah, good luck. Yeah, actually, Westwood's not a bad player.
I would say his case to be the best Premier League midfielder on current form does rest on like factors beyond his control, such as like De Bruyne's fitness issues and the fact that like there's no other big team like fighting at the top of the table who rely on a star midfielder to the same extent.
Best of a bad
Man United.
Bunch.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't want to dampen that, but I'm just kind of anticipating.
There was
responses to that.
Well, there was
that particular statement.
Was obviously Kevin De Bruyne when he's fit is absolutely unreal, but he hasn't been fit all season. Hasn't even looked, even when he has been healthy.
No, absolutely. So yeah, I would say he's the only one with the talent, like the innate talent, to rival Pogba, as you sort of alluded.
To a degree. I mean, there's Bernardo Silva's very good. Obviously, Naby Keita has all the tools in his kit to do it, but he hasn't seemed to put it together. There's not a. It's not like it's a massive. He's not playing in La Liga, for instance.
I'll give you one player who could be rivaling him.
Go on then.
The Basmati Busquets, which we discussed before.
Declan Rice, yeah.
No, look, which tweet of the weekend.
Yeah, definitely.
Coming up with that, PLO was the alternative. Great performance from him, but I'd say he's obviously not the best midfielder. But Fernandinho, the person that Declan Rice is now being touted as, you're saying that not any other team relies on a midfielder to win them games.
Yeah,
perhaps Man City rely on
a defensive
yeah, but
defensive.
It's
not lose them.
It's more subtle though, isn't it? It's with Man United and Pogba is right there.
Also the same is really of Chelsea. You look at the way they rely on Jorginho and Kante to provide them focus and stability and to run that side. I mean, the fact that Jorginho has had a bit of a winter lull has contributed to Chelsea sort of struggling, not looking as sharp as they have, because that's expected, because Jorginho's not used to having a winter break, he's used to not playing in a physical league, so it's to be expected. I think people are getting a bit too antsy about Chelsea, but back to Man United, back to Pogba. He looks happy, he looks as he's enjoying his football, and that's the key thing to getting him to play at this incredibly high level. That pass for Rashford was just unreal, bent space and time.
He said in this post-match interview in front of the screen, another reference of Frank Lampard, I believe, was interesting, because when Mourinho was sacked and when that was happening, there were a lot of reports saying that Pogba took some feedback about being or looking at Lampard in the wrong way.
It actually goes back to during his time working with Mourinho. Mourinho said he gave him the same advice that he gave to Frank Lampard in terms of his dynamism and the points at which he wants to arrive in the box. And while Michael Carrick was sort of developing as a coach, he showed him some videos of Frank Lampard arriving late, and he's referred to this again. Lampard's a player that Pogba even referenced while at Juventus in terms of his goal scoring, his prolific goal scoring rate. So it's probably been a role model for him. Lampard's been a role model for Pogba for several years now, and coaches have encouraged him to him in the pursuit of modelling his game.
What's interesting is, like you say, they've been talking about it for a long time, but it's only really now, well, not just now, because obviously under Conte and Allegri it was the same, but now we're seeing him actually able to do it. Because it's one thing saying to Pogba, hey, look at Lampard, if you don't put him in a position other midfielders capable of passing him the ball in those positions, and other forwards capable of opening space for him, then just saying be like Lampard is pointless, because there's nothing around him. Now Jesse Lingard is playing either as a 10 or as a winger. He creates space, has pace in attack, and this is the thing. Rashford and Martial, very fast forwards. I mean, Lukaku came on yesterday, and Lukaku looked really sort of slow. And it's one thing, Lukaku is not a slow striker. He's very quick. But to make him look, because Rashford and Martial are so lightly across the ground, it just showed the value of pace and attack. And United had that in spades yesterday. And that's what allowed them to essentially sit back. And it was so funny, really, because in many ways, the performance was very Mourinho, in the sense that they sat back, allowed Spurs to come onto them, hit them on the break. It was classic Mourinho, not like this latter-day nonsense Mourinho. It was 10 years ago Mourinho, fearsome on the break, didn't need the ball, could have the ball if they needed it, but didn't need to have the ball, let the team come on them. And okay, at times in the second half it wobbled and relied a bit on De Gea, but that's because they had Phil Jones in central defence.
The one point on that is that formation now, this sort of diamond where your central player is actually a midfielder and is used to sort of lead the press but then also be the break. And Spurs, if you ask any Spurs fans, they're concerned about their fullbacks and that sort of one way that you exploit fullbacks that are going to be advanced but aren't very quick is start spading balls in that channel between the centre back and the fullback.
Two forwards.
And again, what you correctly identified there is it worked perfectly for Man United. The pass was on. That pass on to Rashford was on a lot of the time. It took Spurs losing possession for it to be clearly open, and then Pogba delivered.
See, it was very clever, because I don't think, for example, that wouldn't have worked against Spurs 2 years ago because of Walker and Rose.
Yeah, that's
and
the sort of point
I don't
I
think,
making.
For example, I don't think it would work against Liverpool. I think Robertson would be too quick to get back in the channel, and Alexander-Arnold, well, maybe, but he could play Gomez there and that would work. So, you have to. What was interesting was he diagnosed, they matched formation with Spurs, so everyone, you could at first time be like, oh, they've just matched formation, that doesn't always work out so well, but it was a very clever diagnosis of what are Spurs weak at. Okay, if you press their deepest line midfield, he just stopped the ball from moving forward, which is what Lingard did. And then, as you say, attack the channels behind their fullbacks, inside their fullbacks, because they're not very quick. Vertonghen is not 100%, nowhere near 100%, in fact, and it showed. I don't think he was. I think fully fit Vertonghen gives Rashford much more of a fight for that goal than he actually ended up doing. So it was very clever from Solskjaer and his team.
And it was funny. I was using the sort of StatsZone app, which is very very useful, and under key events. They had the Sissoko sub, And I mean, it's like, obviously, they just put every sub, but it was quite poetic in the sense that it was key event. Moussa Sissoko, red arrow, and then goal straight after.
Yeah, well, that was the one thing, is he was keeping a lid on Pogba. He was closing Pogba down constantly in the game, pressing him. As soon as he went off, I mean, it was no surprise. Pogba was in a bit of space.
We had, became a breakdown, like Trippier refusing to have more than three touches, probably part of it, although it wasn't, obviously, that a lot happened afterwards.
Yeah, a lot happened. But I think
that thing.
If Sissoko's on, Pogba might not have had a chance to paint that pass, but that's all.
That Rashford finish, Lloris actually got a little fingertip to that and it pushed it into the corner, which, again, without sort of grilling Lloris, it was a good finish.
Yeah.
But at the other end of the pitch, David De Gea, 11 saves, which is the most in a Premier League game this season.
Yeah.
Last season, he held that record for his away performance against Arsenal. So he's obviously enjoying these trips to North London, but obviously still being tested. 25 saves in two games, conceded two against Arsenal, got a clean sheet today. Did he sort of reaffirm his status as the best goalkeeper in the Premier League, or was it a case of all these shots, poor finishing from Spurs? Ben Foster came out after the game and said, oh, all you guys saying that all the shots were straight at him, have you ever thought that maybe he's just really good at positioning himself?
To quote the great philosopher Abraham Simpson, it's a little from column A and a little from column B.
Will. More column A or column B for you?
I agree. It ties in with the question as to whether Spurs deserved something from the game.
Where did you get that question from?
His own mind.
The answer to which I would say is no. I think they can feel hard done by the fact that they conceded at the worst possible time, just before half time. Lost a tactically key player in Sissoko. And they were up against like a mammoth display from David De Gea. But to quote another ex-footballer who sort of took to Twitter in his analysis of the game, Michael Owen, he said something very interesting. He said that performance basically shows that how nonsense it is to subscribe to the striker's idiom of just hit the target no matter what, just hit the target. Owen argues that you have to be brave enough to prepare to miss because of the level of goalkeepers in the Premier League. And yes, De Gea positionally was stood in exactly the right place, but as a striker, a top-level striker, you have to accommodate for the fact that you're going up against top-level goalkeepers, who more often than not will be stood in the right place. Yeah. And Spurs were too late, too safe with their finishing. So
I would say that we're very quick in general. I'm not saying that every shot should have been a goal and that some of them weren't straight at him.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, but this is why I'm sort of agreeing with Mo, where it's a little from column A, little from column B.
I just like to think that we should be more positive in our our analysis of certain things. Like when someone makes a lot of saves, maybe it's because they're good rather than everyone else being bad.
True, but I think
when someone scores a lot of goals, maybe it's because they're really good rather than goalkeepers making mistakes.
Argument is essentially we should be more nuanced in our analysis of things like games and really factor in how much goals can transform the complexion of a match. But what I would say, the conclusion I draw from that game is that it could have been 3-4-1 and perhaps should have been, because Spurs had 11 shots on goal. They had some other chances that didn't even go down as a shot on goal, such as the Eric Lemayer header that sort of hits his shoulder. And I mean, that should have at least been a shot on target.
That Winks cutback early on as well.
I think 7 of the attempts in the whole game fell to Harry Kane, like arguably the best finisher in the league.
I mean, this
I could, off the top of my head, pick out 3 of the chances that were such that they should be a guaranteed goal and give the keeper utterly no chance if they're taken properly.
I mean, this is the thing. Kane was really bad yesterday, and he came off the end.
He wasn't bad in terms of his finishing. Going back to the question as to whether Spurs deserved something from the game, I mean, their finishing is an aspect of their performance that sometimes, just like when people assess matches, they say, oh yeah, they played really well, but they were unlucky not to score. But I mean, how is their failure to score is a component of their performance.
I think that's why you'd say that they perhaps deserved a draw, because there was one component that lacked.
No, they would have deserved a draw if they were finishing. Finishing was better.
I think what clouded, or what made it look like more of a dramatic performance from De Gea than actually might have been, was the fact that he saved a lot of shots with his legs, which we're still not used to, I think, seeing goalkeepers do that often. It sounds weird, but I think if he'd been diving over the place with his hands making those saves, I think everyone would have been going mental, and it would have been a thing. Because the shots were close to him and he was saving them with his legs, they looked really dramatic. If he'd just gone down and touched them with his hands, it would have been like, oh, okay, routine saver. Because he's using his legs, it's like, oh my God, amazing. But yeah, De Gea prefers to use his legs.
Well,
like,
we stumbled across this morning, which you may not have been privy to, is that in fact, David De Gea, despite having the second most saves with his feet since the start of last season in the Premier League, in terms of proportion of saves, he's lowly in 13th.
Wow.
And it is Watford goalkeeper that Karnesis that made a few appearances towards the back end of last season.
Remember him?
Yeah, that made 1.89% of his saves with his feet. Well, and Mignolet is second.
Yeah.
So don't use your feet.
I've never associated him really with
to go back to Harry Kane for a second, because I thought his finishing was oddly poor. But then the thing is, I've noticed a trend. He's not actually that good against Man United. That's always the weird thing, because he obviously is phenomenal. He's played Chelsea, for example, 11 times. He scored 6 times against them. He's played Arsenal 9 times. He scored 8 times against them. Played Liverpool 8 times. Scored 5 times against them. But against the two Manchester clubs, he's played City 7 times. Only scored twice. Played United 10 times. Only scored twice. And he hasn't. I don't think I've ever really seen him play well against United. It's such a weird little
quirk. He played well.
Yeah, so they're actually, I think if I'm correct in remembering this, there was a stat going around that 7 attempts while failing to score from Kane is like his most in a Premier League game, or his most since the last time he played Man United.
It does kind of show how important Kane's goal scoring is to Spurs, though, because if he's off even a little bit, he puts so much pressure on everyone else that it's like they start snatching at it. And I think a lot of the shots I said in my match report, I said they weren't like at De Gea, but they were in his wheelhouse, where his reflexes and his legs, the way he uses his legs, means that it's not an easy save for him, but it's something he can do. Like, if you make him dive, I still think if you're making him dive, there are better goalkeepers in the world actually diving across their goal. But in terms of like the sheer reaction speed within like
shot stopper,
you know, within his little radius without having to move anywhere, he's incredible. And I think but I think Spurs, I mean, if Harry Kane obviously wasn't good, but I think he came off limping yesterday, and Pochettino said in the post-match conference he fears it's a bad one.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a problem, because Spurs' squad is already very small. They're about to lose Son for the Asian Cup. If they lose Kane as well, that could be a very, very tricky spell coming up, which is why I always said they're probably not going to make it into the title race long term, because any sort of injury, they don't really have the kind of depth needed to thrive for it. I mean, you saw yesterday Llorente came on, he had a couple of chances and they were just hopeless. And
he should have done better. The irony with De Gea is that like the modern game dictates that you must use your feet as a goalkeeper, and he's probably the only goalkeeper that seems to use his feet
to make saves rather than
because he kicked out of play like 7 times.
He's not a good
so his distribution is not
his performance is to an extent overshadowed the fact that in the second half Hugo Lloris actually had to make some decent saves.
He did
over the course of the game. I think Spurs allowed 8 shots on target. Only against Liverpool this season have they allowed more, which is 10. So which tells you that they actually had a poor defensive display by their own standards, and had a bad display up front, a bad day of things up front.
If Spurs could have scored 4. If United had been a bit sharper in the counter-attacks, they could have racked up like 2 or 3 in the first half.
That save from the sort of Pogba chip or like half volley.
Yeah, that
dink.
Where he like stumbled through and then... His deflected side foot cutback.
Pogba,
yeah.
I think, gave Lloris a high five after.
Yeah. Well, Pogba had like 5 shots on target.
I mean, he's had 18 shots since Solskjaer came in, which is only Kane has more with 19. So he's very much unleashed in this role to go forward and shoot. So
getting that Lampard treatment.
I mean, yeah, it's you know, and that's Lampard scored 20 goals for like what 6-7 consecutive seasons,
Lampard,
something like that.
Lampard was nuts. He's got a long way to go.
Oh yeah, but I mean that's a good role model.
Record breaking Solskjaer is giving him the platform to do so.
I mean, is he the best manager in the universe?
What I would say is that Man United need to be very careful with getting too carried away, because Roberto Di Matteo won the Champions League with Chelsea. and got the job and got sacked.
This is the thing.
There's no shame in being a brilliant caretaker manager. No, there's not.
In terms of full time, you just need to see, can he continue putting in intelligent performances like the Arsenal one? Because like the Spurs one, because it was a smart display. It wasn't just riding the wave of momentum.
To clarify, he deserves credit for executing the perfect way to exploit Spurs' weaknesses in that. So we spoke about Man United, Pogba being best midfielder, potentially in the Premier League right now. Someone that keeps scoring and keeps playing well is Mohamed Salah, who, again, arguments that he's the best player full stop in the Premier League right now. But there's one particular stat that is creeping into the Mohamed Salah discussion, and that is the winning of penalties. And no player in the Premier League has won more this season than Salah, with four. So, Will, I just wanted to ask you, is he conning the referee, or is this yet another string to his bow?
Yeah, I mean, so obviously the context of what you're asking is that he is being heavily accused of diving.
I said it's creeping into the discussion about winning penalties. That's what I mean. The word winning a penalty in itself is a... Did you see Vardy's?
Yes, exactly. And I think... So with Salah, so he's won four penalties this season. Last season, he only won one. And obviously there was the famous stat of it being something like 400 days since Liverpool were last awarded a penalty at Anfield when they won that penalty against Newcastle. I think there is something that you can justifiably see as unsavoury
Your pronunciation of that word.
In the manner in which he goes down, because he does seem more inventive than, say, Jamie Vardy in terms of how he contorts his body to exaggerate the contact. But for each of the penalties that he's won recently, there has been contact. Like, the Paul Dummett one was really, really soft, but he did...
He pulled him back.
But Dummett put a hand on his shoulder, which is quite unnatural, and so that's a pull. Yeah. So, I mean, by the letter of the law, it is a foul.
Yeah.
So in each instance, there is contact. It's not like... It's not a complete simulation.
He's like Ashley Younging it, basically.
And it's just, I think, what people... The issue people have is he does seem to be... quite good at really hamming up the contact, but in the proper way. So he's just sort of taking that contact and moving his body.
Talks about Kane like leaving his leg in for that League Cup in midweek. Is that just like, if a goalkeeper's silly enough to rush out like that when you're getting the ball first, why should you not?
And Pascal Gross did look completely out of control, not in a reckless sense, in a clumsy sense, in the way that he just somehow span himself around and then raked his leg down the back of Salah. He said himself in post-match interviews that he felt that Salah initiated the contact by grabbing him, which kind of shows all you need to know about how confused he must have been in that situation. Yeah. Like, Keaton came out and pretty much conceded that it was a penalty. Obviously, Jurgen Klopp's got no qualms, and Robertson has said that people are just getting a little bit... suggested that people are getting a bit desperate and trying to take Salah down because of
how good he is.
Because of how good he is.
My favourite thing is that apparently... Because everyone wants Liverpool to win the league, referees are being conned by the narrative of Liverpool finally being able to win a title. So they're now more inclined to give penalties. Let me just clarify, I'm just absolutely ripping apart.
Totally. And there's no limits to the creativity of fan theories on Twitter.
Ultimately, diving is a skill. Okay, it's a way talented players use to protect themselves, and they have done for decades. This is nothing new. Players dive or...
But it's new here in the Premier League.
Dive or simulate because they don't want to get hurt, because it's like, these giant guys are going to clatter into me. Mohamed Salah, I think, it's almost like he's thought, how can I get over second season syndrome? I know. And he's... Because obviously he was so good last season, everyone is targeting him more. Now, when he's in the box, people are paying more attention to him. It's like, oh God, this guy's going to score, otherwise we don't deal with him. And I think he's sort of figured out that, okay, if someone comes near enough to me, they're going to knock me over. I'm probably not going to get a decision based on my reputation because I'm a forward, and forwards don't always get like instant decisions unless they fall over. So he's thought, well, I'm just going to fall over then. And so he's figured out that if I get hit, I'll fall over and I get a penalty.
It's almost like now he's just become accustomed to the fact that Premier League defenders are utterly terrified of him. Yeah. And his close control is so good that he can work the ball like sort of 6 inches away from the defender's foot in the box. And
the one example contact. I would give of Mohamed Salah not being a serial diver is that during his hat-trick against Bournemouth, he was kicked down, raked down the calf.
Yeah.
And obviously in that split second, he believed that staying on his feet would give him a better chance of scoring than it would be going down. And I feel like that, making that decision in your head, you'll never get a decision in the Premier League if you do not go to the floor.
Exactly.
That's my biggest pet peeve with refereeing and the diving narrative is that players have to go to the floor because no referee is being brave enough to say, I'm going to give you a free kick when you've been booted.
Yeah.
If you're still up. And against Bournemouth, he was booted, carried on running through, scored, and that smug look was like, I've won. Yeah. You tried to kick me over and I've still scored.
I think we won the penalty in the Arsenal game, didn't he? And where it seemed like he got kicked a few times before he actually did finally go down.
I think it's an absolute credit to him as a player that he's now, again, using another sort of Twitter phrase, he's like living rent-free in the head of every defender. In the sense that you now know, like, if you try and kick him, I've been so impressed with Salah's strength this season.
Yeah.
He's shrugging people off. And there's like, he obviously had that GQ cover where everyone got a bit. Where you got to see the steel abs that he does possess. But this season, he's shrugging people off. And I'm just a massive fan of him being able to decide when he should go down because he realises, I can't score from here. I've definitely been fouled. Yeah. I'm going to go down and get the foul.
That's exactly what it is. It's he's figured out the system. He's figured out that he's like Neo at the end of the Matrix, just blocking all the bullets. He's figured out, okay, this is what I have to do to get what I want, right? Okay, so if I can beat this guy, I'll beat this guy and score a goal. If I can shoot, I can shoot. If this guy hits me, if I can't score a goal by shrugging it off, or if I can't shrug it off, I'm just, there's no point staying on my feet. I'm just going to fall out. He's not like I said, he's not like Ashley Young running around looking for a thing and just jumping over limbs or whatever, you know. He's actually being hit and he's thinking, well, I'm not going to get a freaky if I don't fall over. So, whoop, down I go.
I think Raheem Sterling, who was... Obviously, there was that one moment where he kicked the floor, which wasn't a dive. But he is a player that is often, everyone says, go down, Raheem.
Yeah.
But true. If he goes down, then he gets called, then he's exaggerating impact. Yeah.
I think if you go back to, so over the course of the previous season as well, he's something like second for the number of penalties he's won, just ahead of Salah.
And Vardy was always high as well. I remember that being the case. Yeah. So it's just those quick players. And I think... getting into the penalty area, it almost sometimes people think it has its own jurisdiction. But like, if you're tugging someone's shoulder, again, in the centre circle, you can clearly tug someone's shoulder because you know that it's not going to be, you're not going to get, it's not dangerous to do it on the centre circle. So you do it really exaggeratedly and you're like, right, I've just stopped you from running. But as soon as you touch someone's shoulder in the penalty area, no matter you try and disguise it, you've still committed the same foul. So there's no reason why it shouldn't be given. And players have realised that in order for that to be given, they need to realise the referee's seen it. So it's just...
It's just another one of those debates that will never end because it exists in the grey area. Like how much contact represents too much contact for it to constitute a foul. Mm. Because obviously it is a contact sport, so you shouldn't be... It shouldn't be a question of just one touch is a foul. But
one touch is all it takes.
Hey. Very good.
But just throw me off for making an awful reference that I'd made previously about 7 times the morning before this podcast. So it's obviously in my head for some reason. Just quickly on another theme that's in that sort of top six race, probably look like the worst candidate in it at the moment. Arsenal beaten by West Ham. First win, home win in the Premier League from West Ham against Arsenal for nearly 13 years. And we mentioned him earlier. I think the star performer in that game was the goal scorer, Declan Rice. How good was Declan Rice? One, just quickly. And two, is that sort of Emery... Mo, to quote you, Emery only gets better in the second half of the season. Would you like to revisit that statement?
Wait for the cup games, that's what I'm saying. Right? Declan Rice was very good. Arsenal have... this is the thing, I mean, you and I have been saying the whole time, Jake, is Arsenal weren't very good when they were going unbeaten. They were good. They have obvious qualities in the side, there's no doubt about that. But there's also obvious deficiencies, massive deficiencies that the side hasn't readdressed, that Mintislat has not readdressed in the transfer market. And what's happening now is, you know, in the occasions when your forwards can't bail you out, they can't generate enough attacks, enough goal scoring chances or whatever it is, then the weaknesses become evident. Like Arsenal have struggled controlling games sometimes. They struggle to pin opponents back, and the defence obviously is a massive weak point. So if you're not flying forward and scoring 2-3 goals a game, you're going to get caught out and it's going to be difficult. So, you know, it's a tricky thing with Arsenal because, and I can't remember who it was on Twitter said something yesterday that an Arsenal fan was saying that Emery needs like a couple of years of transition to fix this squad, but the thing is they gave those transition years to Wenger. Like, and so it's like Emery has to come in and fix it now because Arsenal are like, they need, and it's just, he needs this season, maybe even you could argue half of next season or whatever, he just needs more work in the market. He needs to bring in a defensive leader. Because, I mean, all the defenders are good, but they're all secondary defenders. And, you know, they need backup fullbacks.
Well, Socrates is very vocal and loves a little wrestle. Yeah, Arsenal fan, it's really funny to see their relationship with Socrates as well from afar. Because one game, he will, like, tackle someone and he'll be the best signing of the season. Arsenal can see the next game and he's now a flop.
He's so up and down.
Which is funny. I think he's just a decent centre-back. I think that's what you
There's
do.
There's no organiser there. But
I'd say, I think that point about the Arsenal transition period is a very good one because Arsenal's squad, if you look at it, is so poorly balanced that one injury then offsets everything.
Yeah.
You've got so many players that operate in that left-hand side and you build your attacks all that's... Since moving to a 3-4-3, Kolasinac and Iwobi have been the main attacking outlets for Arsenal. That's how they create their chances. Kolasinac is up there with people like Salah and Hazard for chance creation, but that is the only way Arsenal can create chances at the moment. So being that one-dimensional because of the squad available to Emery and also his application of it has now just sort of fallen flat, and now it's quite easy to play against Arsenal now because you can identify what they're trying to do, and when you've got Declan Rice, who played sort of in that left sort of right centre midfield for West Ham, just sweeping everything up, the reason he looked like a magnet to the ball was because West Ham identified where the ball would be.
Yeah, the ball kept going there,
and he sweeped up and obviously got his first goal. Granit Xhaka's header to Nasri's feet wasn't great, and Arsenal fans were really unhappy with him after the game. Most errors from an outfield player leading to goals since the start of last season.
It is just, it's what it is with Xhaka, that's just how he plays.
There's been times that he's been, I think I've seen Arsenal fans saying that he's the player keeping the team together in certain games.
He is Arsenal's Marmite midfielder.
It's just unfortunate that he has it in his locker. It's a bit like Dejan Lovren where he can... I mean, you can laugh at Lovren's comments when he was saying he's one of the world's best defenders. Yeah. I mean, talent-wise, he's very, very good, but unfortunately that's just sort of...
That's half of it.
There's another side of his game and he's always got one of those errors in him.
The thing is with Granit Xhaka is that those weaknesses are so often so high profile that he becomes that scapegoat.
It's not that he makes a lot of mistakes, he makes big mistakes.
He makes big mistakes. And they seem fairly frequent, but then the makeup of that Arsenal team and how it operates at the moment lends itself to people making high profile mistakes.
Yeah.
And you could even, if you were completely on his side, you could make the case that the fact he finds himself in that position to make the mistakes so many times,
Emery is again
just a problem in the sense that he is the only person that seems to be able to get in that position.
Emery ball is high risk football. You will make mistakes. If you watch these teams before, they make mistakes, especially in league play where it's not cup games. They make mistakes. It's a high-risk game. It's not like a safety game. I mean, Xhaka is a player who does take risks anyway. It's a natural facet of his game. And so he's bound to make the odd mistake. It's a shame and it's frustrating, but a mistake shouldn't be looked as, oh, that means he's no good. He's so good. He brings so much to Arsenal side when he plays. It's about maximising his talents and minimising his deficiencies. It's the same thing with any Arsenal player, really, right now, is how can we maximise what they do? You know, Arsenal struggle
And that's the thing about the squad building, is that you've got so many people that have such similar strengths that it becomes difficult to maximise one without forfeiting the other.
Yeah, exactly.
I.e. Mesut Ozil can't make the 18-man squad when reportedly being fit.
Yeah.
Which, to me, is... To not have him in the squad is bizarre. But we've spoken about that.
Yeah, and if it is because Emery's trying to sort of teach him a lesson and knock him down a peg or two, then
Emery
been going on for too long. If the lesson's not been learned by now, then it's just going to, like... it's going to become a horrible, poisonous relationship between those two.
And Arsenal now very much under threat by Man United for that top six and the next fixtures.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say Chelsea at home, United at home in the FA Cup, Cardiff at home. Okay, fair enough. City away and then Huddersfield away.
Yeah, so this is like Man
United. Man United is a very nice. They have a very nice run.
This was what looked to be Man United's worst ever Premier League season. Yeah. Arsenal went on a 22 game or something like unbeaten
run. Best for 10 years.
And they've got the same amount of points now.
The one thing I
weird.
I tried to stitch you up earlier about Emery's second half of the season. One thing I will say is Mo did say that Man United would be sixth if Mourinho stayed, and if they sacked him, they'd pretty much make top four.
Yeah.
It's a very scattergun approach to opinion, so.
No, but I feel he deserves credit because he said that if they sack Mourinho, they have the squad to make an immediate push, and that's what they're doing. So I deserve, for all of my time that I try and stitch him up, I thought it was nice to have his back a bit there. Someone that was stitched up a bit this weekend.
Oh, here we go.
Potentially. Was Mr. Ferdinand on BT Sport.
I mean, was he stitched up or did he stitch himself up?
Yeah, stitched himself. I think just...
I can sympathise. Yeah. As someone who appears on podcasts, and there's always the danger that you're sort of...
He couldn't refuse to answer.
You'll jump into the deep end in a subject you might be a bit sketchy on. But I mean...
Here's your chance to do the same.
How did he look at the situation with Newcastle and think, this is simple enough that I can boil it down to just Mike Ashley spent his own money.
Mm. Well, I think
they should be grateful.
Isn't he? They're represented by the same PR company, or
was acknowledged by them as they were discussing it.
Yeah,
and Ferdinand said, "I don't even know him that well." So, I mean, it's not like it's not something they've tried to hide. Yeah, I don't know whether it's... So, for the most cynical of people watching that, will say, oh, yeah, he's defending someone who has a sort of
exclusive rights to his brand.
Who he has a business relationship with.
Yeah.
You could also say he's just basically... he's tried to play devil's advocate a bit. Mm.
And just become the devil in response.
And he's done himself no favours with his follow-up tweet where he doubled down on his opinion.
Yeah, that was probably the misguided
that was
one.
There were factual inaccuracies in what he said anyway.
Yeah.
In terms of Mike Ashley spending £50 million of his own money to get them up. Despite the fact... Well, I mean, the other side to that is that they sold Wijnaldum, Sissoko, Jan Mat and Townsend that summer for about 70, 80 million. Mm. So, yeah. He also said he doubled down on that though the next day by saying the club's debt free.
Yeah, and Alan Shearer raised that famous hand, didn't he?
Exactly. Yeah, like he's celebrating a goal of 140 million, something like that. Yeah. I think most of that, from the reading I've done around this, is owed technically to Mike Ashley.
Yeah, so, it's that Ashley has said that the club has to him, which is the most hilarious thing because he's out there defending Ashley as an owner.
It was like, and then Richard Keys came out and took a bit of a bullet for him by making an even stupider observation, suggesting that Rafael Benitez should be spending his own money. Oh. I get why some people might feel a bit aggrieved by all the sympathy Rafa Benitez is getting, and because he has to take some responsibility for the performances, etc. But to go so far as to suggest that he should be spending his own money.
I mean, yeah, he came out here like Brick and Anchorman with a trident.
I think what Keyes is trying to do is maybe, if you're being really, really generous to him, he might be trying to make a really roundabout point that, Rafa Benitez is made out to be a saintly figure. And we should sort of perhaps doubt his love for the club.
Yeah,
I don't know. That's if you're being generous, and that's the point he's trying to make.
The tweet has 10,000 replies. Richard Keys.
How many likes?
Likes is 3.8k, which is acknowledgement of how silly it is, I think.
Yeah.
And then only 794 retweets.
Wow, that
so
is ratio.
The ratio.
Horatio thing. Nelson.
Yeah, there you go. I sort of, to make sure I didn't make the same as Ferdinand, I sort of tried to read around, see what Newcastle fans, why they were so angry with it.
Yeah.
And it wasn't necessarily they were angry with, they were angry with what he said about Ashley, but the story is that Newcastle now, who... Rio Ferdinand saying, should they? They're not expecting to be in the Champions. They don't automatically think they should be in the top eight. They just feel there's a Newcastle fans who sell out that stadium a lot. The story that they're sort of being transformed into this sort of business when they were one of the famous football clubs it's the loss of identity under Ashley, yeah, and the false promises of being sold over and over again.
Ferdinand, of all people, should sympathise with the position Newcastle fans are in. I mean, of all the ex-Man United players, he has been the most vocal in what started off subtly, but then kind of amounted to calls for Mourinho to be sacked. So, and he's in a position where he's sort of a club, someone who's affectionate of the club, who's a fan, you could make in inverted commas, maybe not appropriate, having previously played for them. But yes, he's a fan outside looking in who has no influence over actual proceedings. So you just feel powerless and your frustrations are just going to intensify. And this is something that Newcastle fans have had to endure for like years upon years. Like their record signing is still Michael Owen, I think, if I'm right. They've sold players for like 30 million and not gone anywhere near touching that.
West Ham ended a near 13-year wait for something this weekend. Maybe Newcastle's transfer
This is the thing with Rio, though. You look at it, right? You talk about his analysis, the way he talks about Man United. That's actually a good point to bring up, because the Man United's key problem is not Mourinho. It's the Glazer family who run Man United like a business. Now, Man United are operating a much higher capital, the money involved is much bigger, which is why they are where they are in the league versus Newcastle where they are. But it's the same problem. It's the owners running the club like a business instead of running it like a football club. You don't make money in football, really.
And
it's
the Mike Ashley situation is kind of complicated by the fact that his public stance is that the club is up for sale and just no one's touching his valuation. So it's not his fault. He wants to get out, but no one's matching his valuation.
But then again, it's like he's put the club up for sale every time that it's been in trouble. Sort of when it got relegated, they said,
I mean,
fans don't even believe that he wants to sell now. He's just put the sign up to sort of deflect any.
You wouldn't, even if he did want to sell, if you had a clapped out, broken down house, you wouldn't try and sell it like that. If you want to sell it for a decent amount, you'd have to do it up first.
Yeah, you have to do it. Yeah.
And Newcastle right now, in the state that squad is, with the level of investment he's put in, no one's going to match his valuation. If he wants to sell it for what he wants to sell it at, you got to make it a more attractive investment. You got to get some decent players in. Rafa Benitez is a very good, in this modern era of football, Benitez could be a very good mid table manager for a club like Newcastle, upper mid table manager, even pushing Europa League level places. You got to support him to do that. Yeah. Well, I was so amazed when he got the job. I thought that's a perfect club for him because it's a massively passionate fan base. It's a decent medium-sized club, enough size and fan base to support upper mid-table Europa League football if you invest. And they just hasn't invested.
Yeah, there's
at all.
A serious opportunity for brand as well with their sort of history of being the great entertainers in the 90s. And another thing, so on the subject of Benitez, that was another point made by Ferdinand, that Newcastle fans should be thanking Mike Ashley for hiring Rafa Benitez. I think one of the biggest factors behind Benitez's decision to come to that club is the fan base. So Mike Ashley's kind of like exploiting that to lure someone to the club who's kept him in the Premier League.
Yeah.
And his behaviour and his actions since then have done nothing to keep Benitez at the club. It looks increasingly like the only thing keeping Rafa Benitez at Newcastle is the reported £6 million break clause in his deal, where he has to pay that if he leaves before the end of the season. Because he's not even calling for transfers in his press conference anymore. He just looks defeated.
Yeah. Well, I read that this is all reportedly me trying to understand it. Apparently, the Rondon deal was Rafa Benitez had to push that through. It was like, we need this type of striker to do it.
I was going to say, Rafa Benitez had to transfer the wire the money from his own account.
He sorted that loan out personally. But no, it was sort of like identified. And Rondon, who's been one of their best players when he has played, missed a couple of good chances against Chelsea. That was a signing that Rafa Benitez had to fight for. And then submitted his targets January 1st and 2 weeks in, nothing's been said. And as you said, now we're refusing to say anything. But conscious of time, and something that I do want to talk about is, if Rafa Benitez is refusing to admit or talk about anything, Marcelo Bielsa at Leeds, completely open and honest with his assessment of Spygate this weekend, which I thought was refreshing, and also I don't see the problem with it.
I mean, it's not like the American football Spygate where they had, from years back, where the New England Patriots were caught by the NFL basically spying on opposing teams' defensive structures, defensive plays, because that is in NFL, it's all very much play based and diagnosing the individual. It's like a whole bunch of set pieces stacked on top of each other. So if you're spying on the other team's set pieces and the way they're structured, then it gives you a massive advantage because you know how to diagnose their team, where to run your players, and whatever, whatever. Football's much more freeform, so it's not. I don't know. I mean, look, I'm glad he's apologized, and I'm glad he's been like, look, I'm sorry, I didn't realize it was wrong. What's wrong with you people? But it's there's not that much of an advantage you can gain. Like the telling thing is Frank Lampard is like, it doesn't like it, but he doesn't feel cheated by it because there's not that much.
But Lampard also said that the presence of the spy, the Leeds employee at their training ground, did disrupt their training ground. I think on the day before the game took place. That's not good.
Yeah, that's not good. But I think like again, the telling thing is for Frank Lampard, if it was genuinely something that. What can you gain from watching a team train? Not maybe the formation. That's well,
you can,
honestly,
you can learn who's likely to start.
The thing is, it's nothing so game breaking. That's why Bielsa's like, I don't consider this cheating. I've done it all my career because
when he was doing because obviously it was watching it translate.
Yeah.
And I, being a bit of Spanish, I was able to pick up just before. So I was waiting when he just said, I've been doing it since the World Cup qualifiers with Argentina, which is a long time ago.
Yes,
and I was waiting for the translator to just say that. And he looked awkward himself. He looked like he was cheating because he had to deliver it in English.
Yeah.
And it was I just enjoyed, again, those press conferences.
There's a lot to find funny about the situation. I think you also have
to... The backlash
to
it has been hilarious, I think.
But the backlash has kind of been tempered by a lot of people sort of leaping to Bielsa's defence. I don't know if you necessarily need to go as far as to like sort of really like dig in and die on a hill to defend Bielsa.
My favourite part of the...
But the most salient point I think that's been made is that... and everyone's made this point, is that it goes on... It's been a thing in English football for years and years and years. You won't find a club that's not engaged in that side of the dark.
I thought the more salient point was the fact that Frank Lampard owns Marcelo Bielsa's book and now feels kind of bad about it. That was just, he was like, I've got his book on my coffee table. I feel kind of bad about it.
He was absolutely fuming after, before the game.
Afterwards, dealt with it brilliant, I think. In the actual game, Derby weren't very good. And Frank Lampard was like, there's no way a spa made us play bad.
Yeah.
No. And again, I thought that was...
More example, I think, just as an aside, that I think Frank Lampard is destined to be a very good manager.
Says the right things, doesn't he?
Knows how to talk the talk, carries himself very well. Because the thing is, he could have very easily been like, oh, the spy ruined us and his players would... But you know what? Ultimately, the spy didn't ruin them and it would have been an excuse. And he said, no, look, we didn't play well. And he's looking at his players and his team. I think that's just a really, really good approach. And it just shows that he's not the kind of manager who, despite some of the managers he's played for in the past, doesn't make excuses for his team, doesn't look for the easy way out. He said, look, it's our fault, we played badly, and he's going to take on himself. So just a shout out to Frank Lampard, who I think is going to be a great manager.
Again, I thought the calls for like Leeds to be deducted points.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
And stuff. I think Bielsa said it correctly in the sense that he said, I wasn't aware it was this badly thought of. If there's a will for the club for me not to do it, because he didn't ask for permission.
Yeah,
he admitted that as well. He was like, I didn't feel the need to ask. But I feel from that interview that if Leeds said, and there were reports that there was going to be a meeting between it, saying that it's not in the image of the club. If Leeds say, Bielsa, please do not do that again. While you're our club as a manager, I don't feel like he will.
No, he won't. He's not going to be. I mean,
which I think is.
He's like been busted once. If he does it again and gets caught, then it's not going to.
Yeah, that's not going to.
It'd be funny if their form massively fell off a cliff now, and it turned out that this was absolutely
crucial to everything. There's a story that one of his spies back in Argentina was the classmate of his daughter.
And he
grilled him and was, and his daughter came back and said, "Oh, my classmate knows so much about football." So he said, "Bring him in," quizzed him. And then sent him up trees around the country.
He was travelling all over the world with him, apparently. And so, now he's a manager at the...
And now he's at Leeds. But that in itself, so on the pitch, Leeds are now top 4 points clear of the championship. And spy or no spy, doing very well.
They look like they're going to go back up. They look certainties to go back up.
But they did, one thing worth noting is they lost back-to-back games not so very long ago.
It was a three
And so
game.
They have been kind of saved by the dip in form for all their sort of top six rivals, especially Norwich.
It'll be really nice to have Leeds back in the Premier League because they're such a great rivalry between Leeds and Liverpool and Man United. And that whole getting that back in the Premier League is just going to be great. Yeah. They've got such a famous history. And Bielsa's a fantastic coach as well. That's the thing.
Well, this is the thing. So... under Thomas Christiansen, he made a remarkable start to the season and then fell off a cliff massively. So had they like gone up under him or under one of the previous managers, you would have just thought, I mean, that's a recipe for disaster. A team like that.
To be fair, though, Bielsa teams also now they fall off massively. So yeah. let's hang on a minute.
True, but I think now they seem a bit more ready with a manager like Bielsa who's managed at top levels in other countries. And then as well, you would think that they'd be in better stead.
Another shout out to them is their. Like the young English players coming through, and some of them is very nice.
Thorpe Lodge,
And there are plenty of stats on that, but we can't delve in completely to them. The last bit of the podcast, we'll move away from the specifics of in-game action or off-pitch action, as it is for Spies, and just sort of delve into some of the biggest rumours that have been circulating this week.
Transfer season.
And one of them is not to do with a player, in fact. And it was, I was quite surprised to see it, was that despite being the first ever manager to win his first six games in charge of Man United, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer might be under threat from a certain Gareth Southgate.
I mean, look, and I'm sure it crossed your mind when you mentioned it earlier, that, you know, playing two wide forwards and a false nine who pushes forward into that gap is very Gareth Southgate.
Toulon tournament 2016.
Yeah, but no, look, come on. Southgate's good, but I've not seen anything from Southgate that's so exceptional that I think, yeah, get rid of Solskjaer. I think Solskjaer has shown himself, and it's not just Solskjaer, I should clarify, he's got a whole team with him. Michael Carrick is contributing, a lot of coaches are contributing. It seems to be a real sort of team approach, and I think Solskjaer's never really been shy of saying that. So I think Solskjaer and company, let's put it that way.
Still plays for Man City.
Such a good job that I don't think. Southgate is a really good fit for international football. I don't know how he'd handle the day-to-day ground. I think he's great because he's good at creating good squad morale, which is what you need for England. He's tactically sharp enough that for England. But I don't know if you want to apply that stuff to a club, because how good is he at getting on with other players that he doesn't know? That how good is he integrating new talent, signings? How good is he at handling egos? There's not very many egos in the England side. Can he handle them? You don't know. Man United, there's a few egos, you never know. So I think, plus also, Southgate's just great where he is. Leave him where he is.
This is a textbook case of Southgate. Look at what happened to Julian Lopetegui.
Yeah.
This is the English equivalent of that. Like, you leaving Spain to go to Real Madrid, leaving England to go to Man United.
Also,
we should say that this report was that there's a five-man shortlist of which Gareth Southgate is one. The others being Zidane, Solskjaer himself, Pochettino is the dream candidate, and Diego Simeone is another. There were reports in the Mirror as well that they've sort of sounded him out. I think he's got like 18 months on his current deal.
Simeone?
I
think Simeone is gettable. I don't know whether you want to get him.
If Man United are so
unhappy with Mourinho, then, and again,
it's not saying Simeone is doing football wrong or whatever. It's just that he is he has a style that works very well and delivers clean sheets and trophies, but he's not Man United fans will quickly fall out with him.
On the subject of Southgate, though, if ever there was a manager who was like too reasonable to be a Manchester United manager, it's him. It would like he would just, if the results went against him, he would say all the wrong things. It would be like when Hodgson was at Liverpool and gave sort of underwhelming post-match quotes. I mean, if you remember when like sort of David Moyes said their ambition was to play like...
The Man United manager has to be a bit arrogant, has to have a bit bullish.
And I think Solskjaer is doing that really well. He's treading the line between sort of like just assertive and arrogant.
He knows what to say. Like, for example, the one thing that Mourinho kept a lot of people on side with his press conferences, which were world-class to the finish. I will say that about Mourinho. World-class press conferences.
Respect.
To the end. Yeah, and like absolute masterful use of the media. And so he kept a lot of people on side purely off the back of that. So, you know, so, like, I agree with Will. Southgate is such a nice guy. He would just say something really nice and you'd be like, what? Yeah, no, yeah. You're Man United manager. What are you talking about?
It is refreshing, but I don't think it's a good fit for a club.
The thing with Southgate is that he's made a clear progression. England under-21s, as I referenced, won that Toulon tournament, great under-21 side. Now using that core to form the basis of his World Cup semi-finalists. I want Southgate to become the head of England.
Yeah, no, that's the thing.
I think that's his trajectory, and I think club management would be a sideward step in the sense that yes, Man United job is incredible, but we need to milk all of Southgate's skills for that England team, because he's already shown the willingness to use the youth, building, as you said, Mo, incredible squad, and to lose that, maybe that's just a selfish point. No, from my
I think it's not only is it makes sense for England, but I think it makes sense for Southgate. I think his skill set is more ideally suited to being international manager than it is to club manager. Regarding the rest of the shortlist, I think Zidane would be a horrible idea because Man United don't have defenders you can just sort of leave and say, go on, you guys just defend. Unless they sign Koulibaly and like some world-class right-back, I don't think you could possibly hire Zidane and expect to get anything good out of it.
But that would be the plan, wouldn't it, though?
No, well, I mean, yeah, but it's still a huge risk because tactically, Zidane is not that great. He's a great man manager, though. But to me, if you measure to stick with Solskjaer, the only person for me that you really think, okay, so Ole and company, you can step aside, is if you get Pochettino. Because even yesterday, I thought in defeat, I should point out, Pochettino was brilliant. Mm. The way he changed the game, changes without really even making subs. Then he made subs and it also changed the game. Phenomenal man manager, phenomenal tactician. If you get Poch, okay, fine. Otherwise, I'm not really seeing anything. And again, obviously, there's still time to go. So we'll see how Solskjaer handles the cup, handles juggling competitions. But there's nothing so far that I've seen that's making me think, yeah, we need to get someone. Like, Simeone would be so antithetical to anything Man United fans want. Plus, also, I'm not entirely sure how much impact he would have if he's not a club legend. I think part of what helps sell him to Atletico is he's a club legend there. I think that's why his next stop is either Inter or Lazio, because that fits him. I think, yeah, to me, if you can get Pochettino, great. If you can get anyone else, as we just stick with Solskjaer and his team, they're doing a very good job.
Yeah, I would just advise Man United from if they would like to listen to me, that it is very easy to get lulled into the romance of what's happening right now. If you look at Solari coming back, saving Real Madrid, they're now just as bad as they were.
Yeah.
As I said earlier in the podcast, I don't think there's any shame in just being a brilliant caretaker manager. I think he should be part of the shortlist, but he needs to be sort of interviewed again post.
It's almost always because of how low expectations are with these sort of club legends coming in as managers, that when they do well, they surprise everyone and then it sort of warps.
It's about Kenny's thing. So obviously he's riding the wave of good feet. He rode the wave of good feet into 5 straight wins. They were all against teams that you think United should beat. He played Spurs, first big test, did very well. Yeah, rode a bit of luck to get the win. But let's see how he handles further big games, Arsenal in the cup. Yeah. Let's see how he handles the rest. Because, I mean, if you speak again in April. Let's see how he's doing in April. I'm sure he'd have lost a few games by then. We lost a couple of games maybe. How will his team react to losing? All of these things are telling you how he will cope with being United boss. I think, to me, Southgate would be a very bad move for both Southgate and Man United.
Yeah, I think that's just sort of a popular name.
But it's good that he's on the shortlist. I think that's good as well. Yeah. Good that they're acknowledging
his
ability.
Well done for getting on the shortlist, Gareth. one final sort of rumour is, I think the Arnautovic thing, it looks pretty much like he's going to leave, and it will be to China.
Yeah.
No one really wants to talk about the Chinese Super League. So we're just going to brush over that, really.
Yeah. He sort of waved goodbye. I do think in its implications for West Ham, it's interesting because it's probably one of the most awkward transfers to inflict on a club. Because reportedly there's a 20% sell-on fee that will be owed to Stoke. So that's like 9 million off that before you even account for like agents fees and stuff like that. And there are a couple other clubs around West Ham of similar ambition, like Wolves and Crystal Palace, who are all in the hunt for a striker. Mm. And so,
but West Ham just got Sami Nasri.
2 weeks. Right, true.
So replace one mercurial talent for another.
And out of it, the blow to morale, dressing room morale, it can't be underestimated. Like, he's a player that Moyes said was like their Ibrahimovic in terms of. And then Mikel Antonio called him a talisman.
And Wilshere said he's one of the best Premier League strikers, full stop. So,
I mean, talent wise, he's obviously always been amazing. It's just,
But that's what I mean. It looks like he might go and he'll get. At 29, fair play to him. Like, he's going to get
$300,000
a massive
week,
contract.
Apparently.
Like, as a job, he's done that well, and he was good for West Ham. Like, he's not gone there and disappointed. So that's progression for him on a personal level. And then the final rumour that we'll wrap up with is, if we're talking about Southgate's skill set not being fit for Man United, looks like Coutinho's isn't fit for Barcelona, mate.
Ooh, that's spicy. Well, no, it's not really, because he played brilliantly yesterday against Eibar. This is the thing with Coutinho.
Well, one game
against
a bunch of farmers.
They signed Coutinho with this weird idea of making him a midfielder, which was always sort of risky because I don't think they thought it through. Because clearly on the ball, he has everything to replace Iniesta as a midfielder. It's just off the ball. People underestimated how much defending Iniesta actually did, including apparently the Barcelona scouting team. And so when Coutinho played in central midfield, it was fine offensively, but defensively, Barca were a car crash. People could just walk through their midfield. It was a disaster. So you had to take him out and you bring in Rakitic or Arthur or whatever and stabilize the midfield unit, right? So that's fine. But then where's Coutinho going to play? Well, he spent all summer trained to play midfield, played midfield for Brazil at the World Cup. So now what happens? So now he's playing on the wing again. But so now then he got injured and then Dembele sort of found his form. So now it's like, oh, well, I can't get a team. Whoops. So it wasn't so much that he had stopped, like he'd done something wrong. It's just the fact that basically the change formation, so there was only then once, there wasn't a spot in the 11 for him, except one that he was competing with Dembele, and Dembele was playing really well, so he couldn't really get in there. Valverde's begun rotating now that January's here. He played left wing in the cup, didn't play very well actually. Played yesterday against Eibar, played very well, linked well with Suarez, linked well with Messi, lovely assist for Suarez, you know, so he played well. So if basically Barca have three forwards, Messi's always going to play. If Valverde now, because they've sold Muniel Haddadi, if Valverde now rotates Dembele, Coutinho and Suarez in that those other two slots and gets them all playing, then there shouldn't really be any problems. It's weird that the third most expensive player in the world probably isn't in Barcelona's best 11. That's kind of weird, but then that's also because they didn't 100% think it through when they signed him. But
that's the point I was going to make, is low-key Barcelona's recruitment is awful. They're building, like, again,
they had some really weird players linked to them as well, like Glenn Johnson a couple of years ago.
Yeah, and like there's 50
since they signed Eric Abidal, it's gotten much smarter. But yeah, you look at it beforehand, but they signed Malcolm, it's like, why?
Apart from centre backs, they're bad at signing, but centre backs they've been quite like Samuel Umtiti for as cheap as they got to
Stegen cost, they got to Debo for free. To Stegen cost like 12 million, which is incredible.
Yeah, they obviously have made good signings, but just recently the players they're linked with and the players they've signed,
Willian as well, 45 million for Willian.
Malcolm they signed because they couldn't get Willian was a bad enough idea in the first place. Malcolm is basically identical to Dembele, so unless they're going to use him as the backup striker, which I mean feasibly could work, I suppose, that's a weird signing. And he's barely played as a result, of course. Which is a real shame. And then, you know, you look at Dembele, obviously is magnificent and he's working, but then Coutinho, they signed him as a midfielder, which is always a weird thing. Like, why not sign an actual just midfielder? Now they're going to do that. They're going to spend 70 odd million to bring Frenkie de Jong. They're going to try to spend 70 odd million to bring Frenkie de Jong to Barcelona because they need an actual midfielder. Mm. And so it's like, well, then where does Coutinho play? So now Coutinho enters the forward rotation.
Where's Coutinho going to play? Man United.
Well, I mean, that would be tasty, wouldn't it? Just for the banter with Liverpool fans. They're already kind of on the fence.
They don't care about Liverpool fans do not care a jot about Coutinho, they'd have you believe, at the moment, because they're top of the league.
Well, that's also true, yeah.
They got Alisson and Van Dijk for Coutinho.
Wouldn't it be funny
and bought in the power cube as his low-key replacement?
Wouldn't it be funny if Coutinho did return to the Premier League, to Man United, and when Liverpool were Premier League champions? That'd be pretty funny, wouldn't it?
They'd be parading the winners' medals around. And it will be that...
As is tradition for every club.
Yeah, but they'll be doing it. They'll wear them off the bus at Old Trafford.
He may come back with two La Liga winners' medals, though, so there's that, I suppose. Yeah.
But Coutinho's medals aside, all we've got time for. So firstly, I'd like to say thank you. Oh, and also, just a point, anyone listen to that Coutinho explanation in 1.5 speed, that'll be pretty funny, because yes. I think that was your whole article in about 2 minutes, which I just want to say is impressive, but it could be quite enjoyable to listen to it even quicker than Mo managed to deliver it. So thank you for being such a speedy deliverer of thoughts.
Thank you for being such a great host.
Thank you. And Will, thank you for joining us.
Always a pleasure. You're welcome.
And I'd just like to say thank you for listening, and please subscribe to the Squawker Talker. We're on every platform, pretty much, iTunes, Spotify, all of them available. We'll be tweeting the links out on Twitter. Get involved, share it, rate us, do everything possible to make the Squawker Talker even better than it already is. And we'll catch you next week. Thank you.